and Leroy Jones. Wendland Brooks, in describing Mrs. Gray, in her poem The Wall, calls Val Gray a little black stampede. I think you will agree with that description later on in the afternoon. Mrs. Val Gray Ward communicates the message of the black artist hero, a message she feels that has, at least until now, been swallowed up in American culture, but perhaps not digested. She has given dramatic concerts all over the United States, Newark, Detroit, Minneapolis, Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, the Pratt Institute, an endless line of institutions and colleges and what have you. She's also been involved in character roles in movies, such as The Monitors, The Life of Harriet Tubman, filmed in 1967 by the Chicago Committee on Urban Opportunity. She had a part in Medium Cool, a picture that was shown locally. She's been on numerous radio programs regarding black culture, black heritage, and her specialty interpreting black poets and artists. Last but not least of her contributions to the black world are her five lovely children. Mrs. Val Gray Ward is indeed a personification with her artistry of what is called blackness or black awareness, a lifestyle of complete involvement, dedication, love, and passion for her people and their accomplishments, not only in this country, but throughout the world. I give you Mrs. Val Gray Ward.
Thank you. With that kind of introduction, Billy, you're trying to make me stick around here, and I'm not going to be around here next year. And you keep on that kind of talk, you'll have me believing in integration, and you know what I think about that. Brothers and sisters, Faculty Forum, it is a pleasure in one sense, and maybe you people should be honored, because had it been, you know, if a few more white people had come in and no more blacks, I might not have even talked. I got a real hang up about sometimes talking to white people, because they just sit and it goes in and out and they go on doing the evil things. And I got a lot of homework I have to do with black people. But sometimes, and I know that there are some good white people, few, but some. And so maybe it's that kind of thing that Billy Jackson, Billy Jackson's a friend of mine, white friend. Other people, Dan Perino, some other people in here. And I'm not just personalizing, but I'm saying that to say I know that Billy will do what he can to work with white people, which is the job. But why don't we get on with the black artist, the black future? May 17th, 1954. A Monday most Americans remember instantly because it is the day of the United States Supreme Court's unanimous rule that the racial segregation in public schools was unconstitutional. This was one of those days of such historical importance that millions of people, particularly in the Deep South, where the court decision had its greatest impact, remember their precise movement of that day. Most people do. December 7th, 1941. If you don't remember, certainly you've read about it. Pearl Harbor was another such day. So was November 23rd, 1963, and I need not remind the audience of the momentous and shattering events of that day and subsequent to it. These days are recounted in history books and remembered by school children because the events they recollect have had a lasting relevance to the nation. In the decade to come, it is important to look for those kinds of things and those kinds of events which will shatter men's lives, alter the course of history, and become important items of study. The careful student of history, however, must be alert to a crucial fact. More and more, particularly with black people, history will be written and shaped by men of no significantly great stature. That's by white standards. Except that they happen to be a part of those movements and or currents which, at a given juncture, greatly affect the lives of many other people. The history maker may not be another Martin Luther King, nor a Gandhi or Roy Wilkin or Whitney Young. He is more likely to be an artist or activist, both of whom may possess the skills of an organizer. The organizer we know already from their vast reputation, Brother Stokely Carmichael, Mark Rudd, James Forman, Robert Welch, the list goes on and on. Our mission, however, is not to recount their work, but rather to discuss those factors which will make the black artist important to the future of black people and ultimately to the world. The word artist is generally used to refer to a painter, broadly speaking. It refers to any creative person who seeks to communicate ideas, feelings, or moods through his favorite medium, be it music, literature, poetry, sculpture, paintings, photography, or dancing. This is how I shall refer to it here. When discussing the black artist and his role, we must dispel the false notion that an artist is an artist no matter what his color, and that being black imposes no special responsibility on him. Though some black performers deny it, being black does have a particular meaning to the life and work of all black people artists included. People artists included. This happens not to be a conscious decision made by people, you know, by blacks, but a fact of there are lives already decided for us, whether we like it or not, by white America, a white Western culture. For a black dancer, for example, to say that his race has meant nothing to his creative development is to engage in a kind of self-delusion. If this were true, the dancer would have to mean that he has never been affected by race prejudice and that despite having been reared in a white, racist, sick society, his personality and mentality developed completely free of race consciousness. This could only have happened to the rarest and exceptional kind of black, maybe. I don't know if Whitney, some of them might say that it does. For the average black in the white Western world, being black is the most central fact of his, our, my life. There are times indeed when black people are able to overcome the imposed barrier of racism and achieve a measure of personal success according to what they measure success by. There are times that, and we call it a cop-out, that you find these people going around saying, oh, I don't know what it is to be black. I don't care if he has a PhD or DDQ, he be knowing. Can you dig it? But this success that they're talking about, that they achieved, was achieved in spite of racism. And maybe that has something to do with the strength and talent of black people. not in the absence of it, all black people be knowing. There are times when the black artist is unconsciously influenced by his blackness, his body movements as an actor, his choice of ideas as a singer or an instrumentalist. May I have that water, Billy? His speech, his laugh, his walk, or expressions undoubtedly are products of his rearing and his environment. The black artist may have adopted purely Western ways, may have the greatest appreciation for Western culture and values. He may be thoroughly inculcated, brainwashed, we call it in our community, with the white Western viewpoint. Even so, his Western inculcation cannot wipe out the subjective sense of rhythm, time, and speech, movement, his black culture environment instilled within his black body. Mind. Some black artists also are dishonest with themselves in spite of these truths. They proclaim with a passionate and hypocritical sense of rage that they are Americans with some European blood, meaning ancestry, of course, and in the biological mixture, and we won't get into that. The African portion of their ancestry carries no greater weight in their development than the percentage that they may be Irish or French or English or whatever. How preposterous. I could call it something else, like a damn lie. What an intellectual cop-out for any black person to engage in such ignorance, blindness, and sheer dishonesty. Sammy Davis has a routine that he calls Roots, in which he describes the educated, cultured Negro, who carries himself with impeccable grace until one day somebody steps on his foot. Get off my damn foot! He was reverting to his roots. His blackness reaching back into his subjective for a response that white culture had perhaps covered up, but could not destroy. The black artist, like our friend in Roots, may not even be aware of the extent to which blackness has influenced him. But it's a critical situation, because the influence will inevitably surface. To the extent that a black artist hides from or denies his African or Afro-American roots, his courage, honesty, and dignity as an artist suffer. How then does the black artist, if he does admit to the influences of being black, does blackness impose special responsibilities or limitations? If the black artist is special by virtue of color, does he have to act black or think black or somehow express his blackness in his every movement or work? The simple answer to this is no. His blackness will express itself consciously and unconsciously. However, the crucial issue underlying these and related questions is the artist's own definition of himself and his work. The issue has been debated by black and white artists for decades, perhaps longer, whether art exists in its own sake, or is there a related higher purpose? If the artist accepts the first definition, art for art's sake, then he believes that his work is its own justification and cannot be subject to any external consideration or variations other than what he himself chooses to impose. A second school of thought argues that art, like any other aspect of life, is influenced by the artist's own culture and background and the current conditions of his existence. His art, therefore, must be an expression of life as he sees and feels it. Therefore, a Jewish painter reared in Tsarist Russia cannot help but bring the influences of his life to bear in his canvases. The same is true of a black American living on the lash of white racism. What else should be expected to reflect in his art but the feelings of a victim of racist oppression? Black artists, particularly black writers and poets, have frequently been accused of not being universal. Dig it. That is, of allowing race to influence their work too much, therefore supposedly limiting its value and raising doubts of whether the work was art or propaganda. I shall defer for later consideration in these remarks. The bias and short-sightedness inherent in this view for the moment, I want to go back and survey some of the history of how black artists have been influenced by racial consideration. Most of you may not know that there were well established by white standards black painters, actors, sculptors, and orators in the 19th century America. Among the painters were Robert Douglas and his cousin David Bowser, both of Philadelphia, Robert Duncanson from Cincinnati, Edward M. Bannister, a native of Nova Scotia, whose works were well known in Boston, I'm sure Billy and anybody can tell you that, and the great Henry O. Tanner, the most distinguished of all black 19th century painters. None of these men was distinguished as a black or race painter, meaning there was no obvious racial influence in their works. All mastered the forms and traditional themes of their day. Douglas, for example, was a gifted portrait painter who did portrait of prominent white Philadelphians and white women particularly. Duncanson also did portraits as well as landscape. And Tanner, who studied in Philadelphia and in Paris, was the first black person elected to the National Academy of Design in America. His works were consistent with religious themes, and I could go on to name them, but I got more important things, and you can do your own research. But I would like to say that a couple of his paintings were purchased by the French government in 1890. The point is that neither of these men, nor their contemporaries in sculpture or drama or music, was closely identified with the struggle against slavery. White oppression and exploitation after the Civil War, though these were the greatest moral urgencies of the day. These artists were concerned with the whims and frivolities of the white middle and upper classes. There may have been economic reasons for their neglect of human freedom, but I call it a cop-out. But certainly there was no moral justification. True, the art patrons generally were white. Equally true, the relatively few blacks who studied art came from middle-class Negro families and were generally divorced from the liberation struggle as they are today, but they benefit by it. Also, it should be added that the art for art's sake principle was sacred in America and English arts and letters at that time, and it still is today. And these painters, as well as other black artists, may have felt that to deal with slavery or white racism would violate it and therefore make their work more propaganda than art. Such estrangement from great social and moral issues, however, was not the case with major white and black writers of the 19th century. Indeed, the greatest native-born white literary voice of that day were men like Hawthorne, Melville, Emerson, and Whitman, and all were passionately concerned with the issue of slavery. And lest we forget the immortal Harriet Beecher Stowe and her Uncle Tom's Cabin, the book that started a war, in Lincoln's words. Few blacks were distinguished as great writers of fiction during that era. However, many like Frederick Douglass, Henry Highland Garnett, Martin Delaney, John Russ Wurm, David Walker were great pamphleteers and orators and devoted themselves to the anti-slavery struggle. Though none of them may have been considered or considered themselves artists in the usual sense, because they use their talents as writers and speakers in the freedom struggle. An obvious racial emphasis because they were black, they must be regarded among some of the first black creative people in this country. Because they fused their art with politics. It should be added in this connection that though she was an exception, Frances Harper, a black poetess of the mid-19th century, consistently used themes of the slaves, antebellum periods in her works, and contributed much of her time and money to the American Anti-Slavery Society and the African Methodist Episcopal Church. During the post-Civil War period, preceding the turn of the century, there appeared to be outstanding black writers. Two, Paul Laurence Dunbar, all of you know my good brother Dunbar, skilled as a poet, but also wrote short stories. Charles W. Chestnut, generally credited with being the first black short story writer in America. Chestnut was born in Cleveland in 1858, and he wrote this, what's it called, Guford Grapevine. And of course, it appeared in the Atlantic Monthly short story series in 1887. Though Chestnut never identified as a militant and was not involved in politics, his story was done in dialect and the characters were Southern blacks. Dunbar's career was similar. His dialect poetry is among some of the best of the idiom of any black writer. And of course, I might add too, that he wrote a lot of stuff that was not in dialect. Of course, that was published abroad because the white people had to always think he was making fun of blacks when he'd be doing it to be, quote, accepted. Dunbar also shied away from political involvement. And though his characters and themes were always drawn from the rural South and the black experience, he seldom, if ever, attacked the political and social systems of slavery. Dunbar has been frequently criticized as catering to white patrons and being overly concerned with winning the affections and critical acclaim of whites. In this, he was successful because in an Atlantic article in 1900, William Dean Howell, the dean of American literary critics prior to the turn of the century, referred to Dunbar among the truest of our poets. It was generally true then, as can be seen from the illustrations noted, that black creative artists, with perhaps a rare exception here and there, did not enlist themselves in the freedom struggle before World War I. To them, art was for art's survival's sake, and politics was politics, and the twain should never meet. The tendency not to fuse art with politics changed somewhat with the period commonly called the Harlem Renaissance. The Harlem Renaissance was marked by a black cultural awakening. Oh, I tell you that period because some people might not know that, and some of the historians called it the New Negro. How many people are familiar with the Harlem Renaissance? Boy, it needs to be educators, dig it? For the uninitiated then, the period lasted about 1919 or 1915, I believe, until 1931, because that's when Toomer wrote Cain, dig it? And that was roughly sandwiched between the end of World War I and the Great Depression. So y'all ought to be doing your homework if you bees educated. I ain't, remember? The Harlem Renaissance was marked by a black cultural awakening, a new interest among black people in themselves and their heritage. Harlem, New York's sprawling Upper Manhattan's black ghetto community was the center of the emerging movement toward greater black cultural freedom and awareness. The period produced some of the greatest black artists, among them Langston Hughes, Elaine Locke, Claude McKay, Edward Holliston, Aaron Douglas, and County Cullen, and I could go on. It was no accident also that the greatest political ferment among blacks
up to that time, Marcus Garvey, and of course his Black Nationalist Back to Africa movement, was born and drew millions of followers during the same period as the Harlem Renaissance. Both trends, the flowering of the performing, written, and visual arts, and the Garvey movement, drew their strength from a single source, Black racial pride. This period, more than any previous era of Black artist endeavor, shattered the myth that art and politics should not mix. The great historian and activist, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, also wrote poetry and essays along with his scholarly works, decrying the suffering and brutalization of the Black masses. Though a stern foe of Garveyism, Du Bois was politically active as one of the founders of the NAACP in 1909, and for years the editor of its journal, The Crisis, which during the 1920s and 30s served as the major outlet for the works of Black writers. Du Bois, in addition to being one of the founders of the NAACP, was also a Marxist. Though his affinity for Marxism is difficult to date, it is certain that he had accepted and firmly believed in the Marxist analysis of society long before his break with the NAACP in 1948 and his formal joining of the American Communist Party in 1962. And check closely, because I ain't like patting the Communist Party on the back. A Du Bois contemporary within the NAACP, James Weldon Johnson, was also a talented poet and essayist. Johnson was executive secretary of the NAACP and, of course, edited and wrote in The Crisis after Dr. Du Bois. And, of course, his most famous work is Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, and I recommend that you read it, written in 1912. And of course, a collection of essays on the cultural roots of Black people. Johnson's poem, God's Trombone, and The Creation are classic in the study of Black literature. His poem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, is the Black national anthem. His brother, J. Roseman Johnson, wrote the music and became famous, and it became famous as that, as the Negro national anthem. Other Renaissance artists were politically active were Claude McKay, an outstanding poet and novelist of that period, and I didn't think of it until now. How many people in this room are familiar with If We Must Die? Y'all shucking and jabbing because Churchill gave it, and I know y'all be reading it. How many people are familiar with it? Be honest with yourself. You don't have to be honest with me. You heard If We Must Die, Let It Not Be Like Hogs Haunted and Penned in a Glorious Spot. You read it, but they never told you a Black man wrote it, because when we be starting to read it, they be throwing us in jail about it. Well, anyway, Claude McKay, an outstanding poet and novelist of that period, and Churchill didn't give him credit for it either, joined the American Communist Party, and sometimes after its formation in 1919, McKay was a delegate to the French to the Fourth Congress on International Communist Parties in Moscow in 1922. Langston Hughes was also active in that part. I want to skip down because I don't want nobody to think, but it was just the communists at that time who was somewhat supporting, because it too was another paternalistic thing. That was, as long as it included them, if Black was trying to do Black pride for themselves, they would have turned against it too. But political activism among Blacks and the propaganda in behalf of Black freedom intensified with the artists of the post-Depression era, such as Langston Hughes, Richard Wright, Ted Ward in Chicago, Charles White, and of course there are many others that were also involved at one time or another in various leftist causes. And of course their works did and does reflect that intense preoccupation with the problem of Blacks, the poor, of war and economic exploitation. Favorite themes of Black and white artists in the heyday of organizing and propaganda by the communist and social parties during the 30s and 40s. It ought to be noted here that in the discussion of political activism by Black artists, the central point was that the period of activism was also the period in which many Black artists, though certainly not all of them, became aware of themselves as blacks and reflected that awareness in their works. Prior to the late 1960s, when racial themes became the rule and not the exceptions in the works of black artists, one black writer, and again I refer to Langston Hughes because he was consistent, stood out as the most consistent black artist on the point of racial themes in art. In 1926, the year he published The Weary Blues, his first volume of poetry, Hughes wrote, "No great poet has ever been afraid of being himself. We young Negro artists who create now intend to express our individual dark skin selves without fear or shame." 35 years later, Hughes was steadfast in that same view. "My main material is the race problem," he told a radio audience in 1961. "And I found it most exciting and interesting and intriguing to deal with it in writing. And I haven't found the problem of being a Negro in any sense a hindrance to putting the words on paper. And I don't see any limitations in artistic term in being a Negro." At this juncture, something must be said in the same connection about how black artists and a number of black entertainers dealt with the same problem. It will be remembered that during what used to be called the Civil Rights Movement, many blacks and white performers and artists lent their services to the cause. Harry Belafonte was and then does now contribute to the SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And of course, beginning with the March on Washington, and I think diligently he's followed right through to 1966 with Meredith and the whole bit. Their presence, of course, the artist, made it difficult, if not impossible, for black artists to maintain the fiction that his art is not related to his real life struggle for equality and freedom. Also, another point, the same involvement combined with the argument of Hughes, Wright, and Du Bois and others that I mentioned earlier, became the foundation upon which a whole new school of young militants, dedicated, energetic black artists have built their our concepts of work in relation to black people. What has developed in the past several years is a set of theories fusing black art with black life and declaring that as a result, artistic horizon are broadened, old stereotypes broken, and the entire realm of creativity enriched. This new conceptualization of the role and responsibility of the black artist has tremendous import for the black future. It is here that we enter the phase of our discussion on how important the black artist is to that future. I shall deal with three basic points in this area. One, what roles and responsibilities the black artist will have in the future. Two, what kind of art he will attempt to create and how that art will relate to and capture the feeling and lifestyles and new moods of the black future. Three, what kind of future can black people expect? We're all, I'm sure, familiar with the cry, "Black power!" It's not so familiar anymore. Now, as it was 3 or 4 years ago when the phrase was popularized, but not invented, because Richard Wright wrote a book a few years before that, Black Power, and Du Bois had talked about it long before that, and many people before he was born, not taking credit, but putting history in proper perspectives. We should be equally familiar with the extent to which the movement for black power has grown hand in hand with the bourgeois exploding movement of black consciousness and black cultural awareness. I made the point earlier that it was no accident that the Garvey-type black nationalism developed during the 20s as the handmaiden of the Harlem Renaissance. Similarly, my tongue is really going out. It is no accident that in the late 1960s, the period of the most sustained militancy and unrest ever experienced by Black Americans, the cry for Black liberation and Black culture are twin, inseparable. They're inseparable products of the same source and intense pride in being Black. And of course, this time, don't be no turning back. Let's explore for a moment the development of Black power and Black pride in the latter half of the 60s. Both are based on the same set of premises. A, all American institutions are racist to the core. Dig it? All of America's institutions are racist to the core. B, the political powerlessness of Black people, best symbolized by their colonization in big city ghettos, is directly related to the racism of the white power structure. C, that powerlessness, a political phenomenon, has been rationalized by a set of theories of Black inferiority, Black laziness, Black ugliness, Black docility. In other words, a people with no sense of pride, heritage, value in being themselves. D, these theories have been validated by a white man's history and social science, which justifies and glorify white Western culture and standards, and the white Western economic and political leadership worldwide. E, any assumption of Black power by Black people must also carry along with it a rejection of those values and misconceptions which oppose it and were responsible for the initial powerlessness. Black economic political power, its theory, if not the fact, rests on a broad amalgam of ideas which reject the entire white Western interpretation of history, therefore providing the basis for a new politics, a new culture, a new economic, and a new psychology of Black consciousness and pride. F, a rejection of the old history and standards demanded their replacement by a new history and standards which would redefine the meaning of Black existence, past and present. Tell me how much time I got, because I know what to skip. 8 minutes, wow. Well, I got enough Black people in here to hold you all in here until I finish that before I want to. Ooh, we be bad. It was at this point of realization that the Black artist, I'll read a little faster. Wow, I see some people turning a lot of different colors. It was at this point of realization that the Black artist became more than merely a marcher in street demonstrations, a fundraiser for the cause, or a spokesman arm in arm with a leading activist for open housing, desegregated schools, or justice in the courts. The artist became the reinterpreter of the Black past, the redefiner of the Black present, and the analyst of what the Black future will be. He became a creator of a new Blackness, which has made the most significant break with the past of any generation of African Americans. Consequently, it naturally follows that since the Black artist was central to reinterpretation of the past, he must be central to the building of a new future. In answer to the question of what roles and responsibility will the Black artist have in this new future, I can see four major distinct ones, and of course, one minor one that plugs into it. I started to use another word, but I've been using plug in around here, and I dig it. If you don't understand it, go check it out. I shall name them now and explain in detail afterwards. They are one, a creator, two, a critic, social and artistic, three, a propagandist, and four, an activist. Number five will perhaps be as a hero figure to young Blacks, and the last, a fundraiser. The Black artist as a creator. In this role, the artist will simply do his thing to the best of his ability and to the best of his commitment. In the future, he will continue to write, paint, act, sing, dance, photograph, play, and compose. The crucial differences will be that his reason for engaging in his art, the standards governing his involvement, and the kind of art he seeks to recreate or create will be radically different from the old ones. We have indicated before that black art of the future won't be art for art's sake, that it will be based on a newer fusion with the lives and times of black people. And if I may quote Ron Karenga from the quotable, he says, art for art's sake is an invalid concept. All art reflects the value system from which it comes. The number of subjects and themes that black artists may treat is endless. Author, historian, my beautiful brother and black friend, Lerone Bennett, once said that Afro-American history and its materials offers just thousands and thousands of books and plays and stories could be written. And what he meant was that if a writer or an artist seriously probes the lives and varying moods of black people, the material he will find will be endless. He would not have to worry about variations and being caught in a stereotype bag, as some critics, and they really don't be our critics, but some white people be saying. This line of reasoning leads us further to some of the criticism often made of those artists who desire to work exclusively with black subjects or to perform for black people. The most commonly heard criticism, one we dealt with briefly earlier, is the universality question. How the argument goes is, can a black artist be black and universal at the same time? Is he to conform to universal standards? Continues the line. He cannot treat black subjects exclusively, but must move beyond the race issue of his works. Those who argue this point miss two obvious but very essential points. First, their definition of universal. Because it don't be that, see? It's not all that. It's a white Western standard they are talking about. Not one which derives its essence from a collection of thought from all over the world, or even from parts of the non-white world. Their universality is not so cosmopolitan that, say, students and critics of Japan and Korea and India and Ghana, Brazil, would accept its verdicts the same as students in France, England, or the United States. When the white critics talk about universality, he means those forms, subjects, and habits common to the white Western world, the United States, Great Britain, and Western Europe. In this view, Shakespeare is universal, but Richard Wright is not, because we are told Wright's characters and moods speak only to black people. Nonsense, then. If the reader understands Wright's characters and their feelings and problems, then they can become every bit as understandable, or universal, if you will, to non-blacks as King Lear and Twelfth Night are to black people. If we are to believe that universalities, then we must accept Elizabeth Taylor, what is that Welsh broad name, as universal, but reject lovely African and Asian and South Pacific beauties because their standards and beauty are limited in appeal. What the critics should realize, it is they, white Westerners who are not universal, if we are to take the meaning of the word literally. Dig it? The world is 3/4 non-white. How then do critics and students of the arts assume the arrogance to presuppose that themes drawn from the lives and culture and traditions of the world's majority are somehow not universal? Secondly, if a novelist or a poet or musician draws his inspiration only from black people on the south side of Chicago or the north side of Champaign, is it not possible that the person from these two areas are just as human and have just as much to add to the totality of the human condition as the Jews' works, of the Jewish works, or the Jew in the works of Philip Roth or Saul Bellow? Are the Irishmen in the works of James Joyce and Sean O'Casey? Are there not enough materials on Southside Chicago or Northside Champaign to occupy these serious artists for a lifetime, assuming he probes deeply enough and constantly seeks new themes? I'm not suggesting that any black artist confine himself only to the South Side of Chicago or the North Side of Champaign. Of course, either of these two areas, we use them just to illustrate the point. But the black people have a history and a culture that is both African and Afro-American and is worldwide. The same is true of the Italian, Chinese, Filipino, the Jews, doesn't matter, Indian, Eskimos, their heritage is both limited and universal, if one understands it. Hoyt W. Fuller, editor of Negro Digest, used to be Negro Digest, now Black World, has answered the universalist a number of times. One passage from a digest of October 1966 sums up the counter-argument well. He says, no man reaches the summit of his own potential through the conscious denial of who he is and of the forces which have formed him. But there are other questions that the universalists raise which ought be answered. Does the black artist limit himself, his artistic growth, and imperil the credibility of his work as art? If his primary subject and themes are black, the answers to all segments of the question is no. The richness of the black experience in America, South America, Africa, ensures a wealth of subjects and themes which even the most exhaustive artist could not complete ever in a lifetime. The trouble with white critics and the Negro allies is that they never realize the richness, the limitless diversity of the black experience. They saw only the segments which are conventional to white society, in which he has given a patronizing glance. And that's usually to the, quote, slum mother, to the welfare impotent runaway father, the knife-welding angry ghetto kid, quote, ghetto kid. And of course, that's being exploited and explored superficially by whites. You know, so when they tell us to be universal, then, the white critics argue, they should move on to more universal people and don't tell us universality means Jackie Kennedy or Onassis or Al Capone. The new fusion of black art with black life does not demand that the artist consistently fail, argue the moral superiority of anything blackness included, nor flail away at the white man in every poem, novel, or play. They may not even have to always be, there don't have to always be conflict between the hunky and the people. It may be possible to make the strongest possible statement on white racism by drawing characters from all white communities or from the boards of the nation's major universities, or maybe in this very room at this very moment. In short, blackness demands only honesty from the artist, a truth to his being and to what he sees and feels. If these standards are obeyed, his range and subjects and themes will be endless, and his universality never in question. The black artist and the critic, the role is a natural follow-up to being an honest, truthful creator. Black artists dealing with the realities of the black condition and the white condition are strong, forceful critics indeed. I'm trying to rush up now. One could argue that their criticism need go further, however. Upon reflection of the new artistic role, we must add that it must go further. The artist must be certain that his visions of life as it is and as he would like to see it are so accurately and clearly defined that those who view or listen to his work can share his vision. In other words, if the artist is to be crucial in the building of a black future, then he has the responsibility to outline and advocate those laws, standards, and values he feels are necessary. The artist must be the social analyst, the visionary, the guardian of sacred morals and tradition, the questioner and or foe of those people, practices, and habits which don't belong in the revitalized blackness. The black artist must perform this role consciously, not necessarily at the risk of diluting his artistic integrity of freedom. The role of the critic consciously and zealously pursued will follow the maximum freedom indeed, and the era of criticism itself may well be another dimension for artistic exploration. And I wish we really had longer, and I don't usually be big and white people let me talk to them longer, but because I have a very important young lady in this room who is a black critic. The artist as a propagandist. This subject will engage us in a discussion for time long after we will have left this room. Far beyond that time we could ever spend here, it goes right to the heart of what academic purists in this country call non-ideological and scholar art and scholarship. Their argument is that art and scholarship must be pursued without the imposition of ideological consideration, which, if felt, will prejudice the results and jeopardize its integrity. While I agree with some of the essentials of this argument, I do not agree that it prevents the black artist from fulfilling the role of propagandist. That role comes naturally if the artist is true to his subject, as he honestly sees and feels them. John Killen says of the black writer, "It is time for black writers, the more the merrier, to move from social protest to affirmation and revolution." Every black writer worth his bread is a revolutionary of sorts. Each time I sit down at the typewriter, John says, I'm out to rock the boat, to change the world, to break the world down bit by bit, and to forge it into something altogether new and different, to create a new image and new visions for mankind. This vision calls for black writers to write our own history, create our own myths and legends. Washington and Jefferson and Lincoln do not belong to our black children. They are not our legendary heroes. They are our villains. No amount of falsification of history can disguise this brutal fact. Our legendary heroes are Nat Turner, Frederick Douglass, Denmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman, and dig it, we integrated it, John Brown, and Red Sitting Bull. The statement was long but straight to the point for me and John Killens. You notice that he was universal? He's integrated our list of heroes with John Brown and Sitting Bull, as I said it before, and they be from everywhere and everything. The Killens point not to be missed is that artistic honesty, as well as his blackness and the moral imperative of the liberation struggle itself, compels the black artist to take up this role. Killens mentioned only writers in this, but it goes for all black people, because artists are not different from cooks and floor sweepers and mathematicians and chemists and TV, whatever you be, all you got to do is be black. Emir Baraka, formerly Leroy Jones. He says the black artist's role in America is to aid in the destruction, y'all hold on to your seatbelts now, of America as he knows it. His role is to report and reflect so precisely the nature of the society and of himself in that society that other men will be moved by the exactness of his rendering, and if they are black men, grow strong through this moving, having seen their own strength and weakness. And if they are white men, tremble, curse, and go mad, because they will be drenched with their filth of their evil. Baraka makes the same prescription for the black revolutionary theater, for which he is known at least as much as for his searching poetry. He says that revolutionary theater should force change. It should be change. The revolutionary theater must accuse and attack anything that can be accused and attacked. It must accuse and attack because it is a theater of victims. It looks at the sky with the victim's eyes and moves the victims to look at the strength in their bodies. So here we have from two of the most successful, and I'd like to use another word, but I be's limited, black writers. Artists in the broad sense, for both are at home in every one of the mediums of our thing about black art. Implicit in both definitions is the assumption that the black artist's role is morally bound to take up the cause of black liberation in his work. And perhaps more than other, but all to the same degree. The assumption rests on two arguments, that no black artist can be true to himself and having been born, reared, and shaped by white Western, meaning racist institutions, without dealing with racism, at least by implication, the black liberation in the black liberation struggle. If he is to reflect those forces and values which gave him his being, his vision of the world, how can he avoid dealing with the world from his point of view and remain honest? Number two, although artistic freedom allows the artist's choice of subjects, moods, and themes to treat, that freedom does not permit him to skirt the responsibility to black people and, in the larger sense, to all mankind, because John Killen says it's the black man's burden to straighten it out. Y'all done messed it up. If there is any limitation on the artist's right to choose his medium, subject, and level of work, it is the overriding imperative of his own freedom as a person, his manhood, and the sacredness of his life, as well as the lives of those who purports to explore or to influence it. There are two further things, and I'm going to try and skip some commentaries on the point of fusion of black art with black life, which should be noted to solidify the point concerning black artists' role as a propagandist. One statement is from a black poet by the name of Clarence Major. The black poet, confronted with Western culture and civilization, must isolate, define itself as a bold a relief as he can. He must stretch his consciousness not only in the direction of other non-Western people across the earth, but in term of pure reason and to expand the mind to the far reaches of creativity's endlessness. I believe the artist does owe something to the society in which it is involved. He should be involved fully. This is the measure of the poet, and the black poet in his invincibility must hammer away at his own world of creative criticism at this society. I'm trying to rush now. The second statement is by Larry Neal, and I would suggest that you get Ebony Magazine, August 1969, and that's called Revolution. And of course, Larry speaks of the black aesthetic. And he said, when we speak of the black aesthetic, we mean more than the process of making art, of telling stories, of writing poems, of performing plays. We also mean the destruction of the white thing. We mean the destruction of white ways of looking at the world. For surely if we assert that black people are fighting for liberation, then then everything that we are about as a people somehow relates to it. Our art opens us up to the beauty and ugliness within us that makes us understand our condition and each other in a more profound manner, that unites us, exposing us to our painful weaknesses and our strengths. And finally, an art that posits for us the vision of a liberated future. The black artist as an activist. The role, more perhaps than any other we've discussed, reveals a critical difference between younger and older artists. And of course, most of us participated in CORE, and I call myself in the young ones because I hang around with them, but I'm really much older than a lot of them. Of course, there has been a break between some of the older and younger artists because some of the things that they're afraid to do and a claim that they're looking forward to, we just be going on doing what we have to do. And I'm not calling myself an artist at this point. It's one of the things I'm striving to be, and then history will have to say. The activist role has a practical side and a creative side in terms of practicality. The black artist, like other black people, may one day have to engage himself in the struggle for sheer physical survival, and that's coming down right now. He may have to pick up the gun and use it. If not that, he may be thrust in the position of a given moment of time. As the chief planner or theorist for a particular phase of the revolutionary warfare, even if these eventualities don't occur, the artist from time to time needs the exhilaration of personal contact with things happening in the communities. This leads us to the creative side of the question. If he, the artist, is to capture the feeling and spirit of those critical movements among black people, he must be there. He must be a part of it. He must be a part of them, us. Among and of the people doing the marching, the brick throwing, and we passed the marching and brick throwing, the shooting and the dying. This kind of involvement is a matter of personal commitment to the struggle and a matter of the black artist being able to grasp the full meaning and scope of the event. This is not possible by simply reading newspapers and magazines and watching white television, or even by talking to people that were there. These are essentially secondary contacts. No replacement for the personal witness of an event. Murray Kempton, the liberal columnist for the New York Post, once said, "The only way for a reporter to cover a happening is to be there." So the same holds true for a black artist. He must be there. Activism brings up the question of how the artist is to be used in his time. The question arises sometimes rarely and sometimes naively from those who feel some strict rules have to be established, lest the artist spend too much time with the brothers in the street and not enough time creating. The answer is every artist must find his own level of activism. This cannot and should not be imposed from without according to an arbitrarily drawn guideline. However, it should be added that being in touch with brothers and sisters in the streets and the church or wherever they are, or on the corner in bars, is acting in the struggle, is a critical phase of the artist's preparation for creation and recreation, spiritually for further creation artistically. The black artist as a hero, and this is very important, though we deal with it very short, there is a minor role which may or may not be thrust upon artists, and indeed may never be thrust upon any, no, that's not true, it will be thrust, it is there because the damage has been done. And it's important to discuss, however, because of the crucialness of the artist's place in building and shaping of the black future, we need be black heroes. Outside of those image figures that young people find within their own families, the most popular hero figures to young blacks have been athletes like Joe Louis, Sugar Ray, Jackie Robinson, Willie Mays, Gale Sayers, and that's just to name a few. Though their value to black children and as black hero figures were grossly inflated by white people, particularly the press. The hero figure, nevertheless, does have a place in the life of black people, if only to serve as a symbol of a healthy adulthood. Black athletes, for the most part, was never the clean livers and good Christians they were made out to be. In real life, they most frequently were precisely the opposite. The black artist, because of the increasing importance of his place in the emerging black communities across the land, may find himself thrust into the position as one of the most popular, requested, and respected hero figures by young blacks. If one examines the popularity of Carolyn Rogers, Amir Baraka, a Don Lee, a James Baldwin, a Gaston Neal, a Larry Neal, one would find elements of black artist heroes already emerging. The black artist may not be the signers of autograph or you see them on television, you see, because they don't be having us autographing cars and things. But his influence through his works and his personal example of discipline he sets will undoubtedly, and it does have effect on black heroes because we are trying to be living examples of what we talk about. The black artist as a fundraiser. We're talking about taking our responsibilities. And I can just skip on down because I want to get to the last page. We're saying now that as we work, and y'all be giving us the middle class job, we don't be selling out no more. We be taking care of our responsibility. As you can see, from this brief discussion that black artists of the future will be a spiritual, social, cultural, political animal, basing his life and work on concept, blending all aspects of his life into a perfect harmony, removing from him the, my husband put this word in here, because like I really don't be digging these big words, monasticism, art for art's sake, let me call it, into direct contact with social and political realities. In detailing black artist's role, we've spoken to the point of what kind of art he will attempt to create and alluded to the standards which will judge his work. What kind of future can we expect? What kind of future will he help to build? More properly, some would argue, the question ought to be, will he and black people have a future in which to build? The point is not frivolous, but deadly serious. The future of black people in this country, or black people in the world, will be determined to a very large degree by whites, by hunkies, by people in reaction to the continued and inevitable demands for black liberation. Black people will determine the pace and intensity and substance for the demands. But white people will ultimately determine the granting of some of those demands and how soon. With this background and the conflict clearly drawn, the option for the future of black people appears to be limited to either repression, genocide, which is taking place, continued hostility, racial separation as a form of tenuous coexistence, migration to the motherland, or simply social and political stagnation, a total destruction of this planet. Where we do little or nothing and just hope, or do we just do nothing or hope for a solution to the problem of race and class? Is there reason to hope for a just solution? Does such a solution seem imminent? Both answers are no. For an affirmative answer to either must be based on an honest assessment that white power structure is changing fundamentally and accepting the inevitability of sharing power, wealth, and freedom with non-whites. No such assumption can be made at this very moment. And yet it is this very change in white people with power, that must be the essence of a just an orderly and free society for blacks and whites. I had suspect, and I've not marked it out because I know that white people haven't changed because they are convinced they don't have to, that despite the big city rebellions in recent years, despite the rising tides of militancy of young blacks and whites and revolution in the country, basic social and political and economic change really isn't necessary, they think. They think that those problems of social unrest can be solved by simply hiring more policemen and giving them more guns and the authority to use them whenever they deem it necessary, or by calling in Spiro Agnew and allowing him to cut loose on anybody or anything white America doesn't like. I hope this assumption is wrong, but there is every indication that it's right. What then does the obstinacy in white America portend for black people and black artists? For black people, the only option is continued struggle, a heightened, sophisticated resistance to white oppression, which demands either liberation or death and destruction of all of us. And there spurns no or any middle accommodation. For the black artist, his dilemma is that despite his realization of the black burden and white responsibility, he is limited for the time being, at least in addressing audiences as this today. Because we really have to be in our own communities doing our own homework. So it is up to you as artists, as teachers, as doctors, as administrators, to to do your own white homework. The task of persuading the white power structure of this country to become moral, if they don't be too sick, and rational, rests with white artists and you as white people. In conclusion, I say to them, you, and to well-meaning whites, wherever you are, that this is your task for the future, not to seek work or understanding or chances for study among black people, but to exert your energies, changing the minds and hearts of white people. And believe me, changing the hearts of white people, and I ain't talking about them, they're taking out us, putting in y'all, and heads of the poor, and heads of the power elite of Chase Manhattan Bank are worth far more in Northeast Champaign and in Harlem and in Africa than it is your white missionaries. I would like to close on my struggle toward liberation and with my position as working toward becoming a black artist, reflecting truth, doing whatever is necessary for the liberation of black people and the survival of the world, if it be, with a poem by a black artist by the name of Mara Evans in Indianapolis, Indiana. I am a black woman. The music of my song, some sweet arpeggio of tears, is written in a minor key. And I can be heard humming in the night. I can be heard humming in the night. I saw my mate leap screaming to the sea. And I, with these hands, cupped the life breath from my issue in the canebrake. I lost Nat's swinging body in a rain of tears and heard my son scream all the way from Anzio for peace he never knew. I learned a Da Nang and Pork Chop Hill in anguish. Now my nostrils know the gas and these trigger-tired fingers seek the softness in my warrior's beard. I am a black woman, strong beyond all definition, still defying time and place and circumstance, assailed impervious, indestructible. Look on me and be